Hey, welcome to Info Under the Radar, the show where we talk with an expert to simplify everyday ideas, concepts, and subjects that surround us.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Info Under the Radar. I'm your host, Vishwajit.
And I'm Devendra.
And today we are talking about a topic which is a little out of our comfort zone, as some might say, where we are talking about peace and conflicts and the whole concept of peace building. Rest assured, we are not gonna be passing on any comments and judgments while sitting in a very comfortable position, but rather we have invited someone who is not only a researcher in the field, but has a very interesting personal story, which in our opinion justifies his appearance on this episode. We are talking about Professor Aaron Halperin. He's a researcher based in Israel. Dave will go in his bio in just a second, but more importantly, he has this amazing personal story of how he was not just grew up in a conflict, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but also was a soldier there and was part of a violent solution, in some might say. And now he has this whole life which he has built up in the last two decades, which involves the opposite spectrum of violence, which we call it peace. Dave, maybe you want to give us more information about Aaron.
I mean, his journey in itself is interesting, and this kind of balances out the reason for us choosing the topic as well, right? Because it's like, we can talk from the comfort of our own houses about a lot of stuff, but bringing him as a guest, it's pretty much straight from the horse's mouth, as much as I can think of. So Professor Aaron Halperin is a professor at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. So conflict begins right now. But he's a professor at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And as part of Israeli policies, he was also part of Israeli army, but not just any army. He was part of the Special Forces Unit. And in his personal story, he would justify it better than either of us, that what major loss and trauma that he went through came out of it. And in a matter of 7 years, was able to finish his bachelor's, master's, and PhD, give his life an entirely new and diametrically opposite direction on the way he approached conflict, from a more, how do you say, a violent end to a more research focused, more civil person end.
And to then a peace solution, basically.
To a peace solution based, and from there, as of today, as we speak, he's a very accomplished researcher, of course, who's leading heavily funded projects funded from EU or the US in the domain of intergroup relations and peace building primarily. He's an accomplished author as well. And the title of his book is Emotions in Conflict, Inhibitors and Facilitators of Peacemaking. He has been an editor on several other books that revolve around the idea of conflict theory. So yeah, from both a theoretical, practical, personal experience, he understands conflict because he's grown in it. And now I think that he understands peace building from a lens that probably most of people wouldn't in their entire
lifespan. Including the researchers.
Including the researcher outside the conflict region.
Because of his personal story is just so amazing. And that's why we are so excited to present you, Mr. Aaron Halperin. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to Info Under the Radar. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on the show. And before we go into the weeds of conflicts and peace and psychology, etc., I think it's very important to shed a little bit of light on your personal journey, because I also find it very fascinating that where you were two decades ago, like we were just talking before the recording, and where you are now, there are two different extremes, some might say. So I was wondering, what was your view before you joined the army, where you were an officer two decades ago in Israel, and now since you are on the other side where you are working on peace building, what is kind of the difference in mindset towards the Israeli-Palestine conflict, you see, and what led you to this major movement of the world of, some might say, violence, that's how people associate army with, to this entirety of peace?
Wow, it's a great question, but the answer might be a little bit too long. How many hours do we have to talk about my journey? No, I'll try to make it as brief as I can. I will say, you know, I was born and raised as part of a conflict. That's a big thing. You know, when I was born, my father served in the army, and we had, you know, friends who lost their life in the Israeli army, and being part of the Israeli society, and the same thing is like being part of the Palestinian society, it means that you are part of the conflict. The conflict is around you all the time. It's in the conversation. It's what people talk about. It's having family members that were injured. It's always having someone from your family serving in the army right now, and you know that anything can happen every day, and it's a mindset that is very different, I think, from the mindset of people who are not part of such long-term conflict. And also the fact that it's almost natural, like that's the default behavior of, you know, us Israelis at the age of 18 to go to the army. And, you know, we say there's something you learn in school saying, yeah, like it's good to die for your country. Something that is, you know, from my perspective right now is first of all, as a father, and then also as a researcher, it's a crazy thing that this is one of the first thing you learn at school, like good to die for your country. And you should know that, you know, when you'll be 18, that's your mission. Your mission is like to go to the army and protect your country. I will say that, you know, I come from a very left-wing family, and I was born and raised in a family that always supported like peace and compromises and things like that. But even though I was raised in such family, it was very, very clear that I should go to the Israeli army. I should do my best, and do your best is to be in a combat unit, in a special unit, be an officer, do whatever you can. And it's a very, you know, psychologically, it's a very complex situation. I can tell you that, you know, when I served in Lebanon, where I was later on injured very, very seriously, my mother was part of demonstrations across the Lebanon border against the Israeli government saying you should take your soldiers out of Lebanon. Wow. As an 18 years old, like young man who believed that, you know, I'm probably doing the most important thing in my life. I remember myself telling my mother, you know, you don't understand anything. You're a traitor. You shouldn't talk like this. We are defending the country. And you know, I know today from my perspective as a researcher that, you know, that this is part of the like socialization process you go through when you are part of a society in conflict. So then like back in 1997, I was very seriously injured. I was hospitalized for almost 4 years. Both of my hands were injured. I lost one of my lungs. And it's interesting because when you spend so much time in the hospital in rehabilitation and both your hands don't function, you know, there are many, many downsides to it, but what one thing that is an advantage, you have so much time to think. And for me, it led me to first realize that, you know, that's what I want to do in life. I mean, what I want to do is to devote my life. Basically, I know these are big words. It sounds maybe a little bit like cliche, but to do something that can help or make sure that others, both on the Palestinian and on the Israeli side, would simply not have to go through what I went through, but mostly what my parents went through and my family, like you know, experiencing these kind of things in your family. So the first thing was realizing that, you know, that's what I want to do. And the second thing was another understanding that, you know, I felt like we keep on doing the same things, trying to change the situation. And we are repeatedly surprised that they don't lead to any change. So we really, really need to maybe to think of like doing something completely different. And I truly believe that what I do today in terms of research, but also in terms of my more applied work, is like bringing like a very fresh, very different approach to thinking about conflicts. Like not so much focusing on, you know, questions like, you know, where should we draw the border? What would they get and what should we get? What kind of, but instead asking questions like, you know, how do we moderate extreme emotions? How do we change mindsets? How do we change the way people think or feel about the conflict? And that's where I believe that the real solution can be found.
I must admit though that me and I assume most people have always heard of war injuries or soldiers or veterans getting injured in war severely, but to hear it firsthand from you, it's still like it never ceases to shell shock me, figuratively speaking, that this happens. So thanks for sharing the story first. You mentioned one thing, that if you're born in Israel, or we can also generalize it to many other parts of the world where similar situations have been, that a conflict is a part of your life. Now, I'm assuming you would have a slightly better understanding of what conflict actually is than, let's say, someone who has been, by some virtue, privileged enough to not face a major one in their life. Do you think conflict in itself is a very primal instinct for humans, because it has been a part of our history and evolution since, I don't know, centuries maybe, to say the least? So do you think conflict is a primal instinct for humans, like anger is or fear is?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that, you know, we study mainly conflicts in the intergroup context. And I definitely think that conflicts between groups, and groups can be, you know, identity groups, religious groups, national groups, it's definitely part of, I don't know if I love the word instinct, But I would say that it's part of the like natural human and social dynamics. So I would say that, you know, mainly because of the fact that, you know, our group helps us to define who we are, and we draw much of our, you know, confidence, security, and also like positive self-image, we draw it from our identification with the group. And the only way our group can provide us with what we need, you know, feel secured, feel like I'm a good person, like I'm a moral person, I'm competent, is by comparing it to other groups. So the mere process of comparison already creates conflict. And it creates conflict even before we have anything to fight for or about. So in a way, what I'm saying is that it's almost like, you talked about an instinct, and it's almost like an instinct because it's a basic need that humans have to feel that they're part of a group, to compare it to another group, to believe that we're better than the other group, and to somehow maintain power in the hands of our own group. This creates conflict. And then if you add to this the layer of, you know, the more realistic and symbolic like threats and disagreements, then conflicts must be like, you know, part of our life.
We have covered this basic idea now that you think that there is some organic need for people's belonging in a group, and then conflict creating out of it. From a rather slightly theoretical perspective, before we move on into more examples, can we divide conflicts into certain categories? Is there a difference between different types of conflict between groups?
Yeah, wow. So it's the answer is definitely yes. And I think that the, you know, Very simply, we can start by differentiating between conflicts on an interpersonal level, which is mm-hmm. one thing, versus conflict on a more like intergroup level. That's, right. that's the second thing. Then I think that there's, you can think of different conflicts that are driven by, you know, conflicts are always driven by threats. And you can think of different conflicts that are driven by different types of threats. So one conflict can be driven by threats or disagreements on very realistic, like resources. You know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is basically on the land, or the question of the land, right? Mm-hmm. Other conflicts can be on more materialistic, like threats or disagreements, like I don't know, like oil or like some you know, money or budget or whatever. Whereas the other conflicts are more on or more based more on like symbolic or cultural threats and disagreements. Mm-hmm. So people can have conflicts regarding, you know, very basic like moral values or religious convictions, and they don't have to be around very tangible or realistic or realistic disagreements. So another way to think about different types of conflict is to think about, you know, what are the types of disagreements or threats that led to each and every one of the conflicts. And then there's another approach that is basically saying, let's look at conflicts according to the, like the intensity of this conflict or the estimated probability of actually resolving these conflicts. So for example, I study or we rely on a theoretical framework differentiating between conflicts on a spectrum saying, whether these conflicts are tractable or intractable. Mm-hmm. And there are certain parameters that can define or help us define whether conflicts can be, whether we should look at them as tractable or intractable. So for example, when we see a conflict in which the conflict continues for more than two generations, mm-hmm. when it involves violence, when both sides believe that the conflict is irresolvable and it's a zero-sum perception like kind of conflict. Mm-hmm. When it's very central to both sides, so these conflicts go more towards the direction of what we define as intractable conflict.
So you will say Israeli-Palestinian conflict or Korean conflict, they are like these type of conflict, right?
So the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for many years has been considered like one of the, you know, prototypical examples of intractable conflict. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that this is the situation today. So there are some changes over the years on whether or not we should see a conflict as intractable. Mm-hmm. I would say that today the situation in the Middle East is a little bit more nuanced, mm-hmm. a little bit more complicated. The Korean conflict is definitely considered these days like an intractable conflict. We have some work done in terms of public opinion in that conflict as well. The conflict in Cyprus is considered an intractable conflict, but it's important to say that this is a dynamic definition. So things can change throughout the time.
You said historically Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been considered intractable, but around 1994, you guys came really close to resolving it, isn't it? So then doesn't that kind of contradict the fact that, I mean, maybe it has been started to, maybe people started considering intractable once that failure, or do you think it has always been considered intractable and it was some sheer political genius that they were able to come that close? Like it was almost close to being like as close as it has ever been in history, I guess, right?
I agree. Yeah. In 1994, mm-hmm. During the Oslo Accords, mm-hmm. and then after, you know, in 2000 and 2001, in the negotiations between Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat, mm-hmm. with the mediation of Clinton, we were very, very close. Mm-hmm. And I think that in these periods of time, you could have, you know, if you take 3 or 4 years before each and every one of these events, you could have seen indications for change. For change, you know, suddenly both societies realized that it's not really a zero-sum situation. So it's not as if everything they gain mean that we lose something. Some things are more complex. Suddenly you could have seen among both societies that more and more people believe that something can change. There are things that can actually change. Sometimes, so there were indications before the Oslo Accord that something meaningful can actually happen. But if you look at, you know, late 70s, during the 80s, we were really, really, really stuck in a situation that no hope, very wide despair, a lot of hatred among both societies. So it is a dynamic process.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, to get a little bit going into this type of conflict scenario and understanding how do you consider for the newer conflicts per se which arise, how do you categorize them? So for example, there are, I don't know, like what happened in Iraq in 2003, 2004, I guess, right? To someone who is not coming from this research area, to me, it's also there is some conflict there, right? But to me, it seems like a relatively new conflict by your definition, because their two generations have not been even passed. So how do you look at these kinds of per se newer conflicts or for example, what happened in Libya, in these kinds of places?
Or Afghanistan. Yeah,
or in Afghanistan. How do you categorize these kinds of conflicts?
So I think that one very meaningful point that I want to emphasize is that, you know, conflicts can be very, very, very intense, you know, mm-hmm. very violent with many people, mm-hmm. you know, sacrificing their lives. And but still they will not be considered yet as intractable conflicts. So they can be very intense, but you can see very immediate and short-term like changes, both, you know, to become more and more extreme, but also to become more and more moderate. In order for a conflict to become what we define as an intractable conflict, something deeper has to happen. Mm-hmm. And this is something that is involving usually, you know, the societies themselves. So people have to go through a very long process of what we call like socialization for the conflict. You know, think about my family, okay? So both myself, my kids, and my parents, we have never, never experienced a situation of non-conflict.
Mm.
All of us, it's like three generations, we were born into a conflict. And the fact that we were born into a conflict, it has huge implications. It means that we cannot even imagine or entertain the idea of a different reality. You know, one of the most important things in any situation in life is that when you are experiencing, now I'm talking as a psychologist or as a social psychologist, but when you are experiencing a very, very difficult situation, no matter what it is, like a health-wise, family-wise, political-wise, you gain or regain hope by being able to imagine that the future can be very different from what you experience right now. And in most situations in life, you do it by going back to the past and relying on the fact that you've lived in a very different or much more positive situation. When you ask Palestinians today or Israelis today, would you be willing to make compromises for peace,
mm-hmm.
they say, but I don't know what peace is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, my life as I know them are like conflict life.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I know. And you know what? It's not so bad. You know, I got used to it. It's perfectly fine. Now you're asking me to make huge compromises to achieve or to get to the point or to a situation to be honest, I don't know how it feels. I don't know if it's really so much better from my situation right now. So the intractability of the conflict has something it's very, very closely related to the question of, you know, the time and how long does the conflict, you know, continue. And in this sense, you know, it's almost orthogonal, the question of intensity on the one hand and the question of intractability on the other hand. They are related, but also very, very different.
I think you said something very interesting, that you don't know if how it will be on the other side, let's say, right? If the conflict does not exist, but you also think that, okay, life is not too bad, right? It's okay. We don't know how it will be on the other side. But don't you think you are saying this is someone coming from a stronger group in this conflict? I'm not sure if the sentiment is shared, is also shared by Palestinians who are more on the weaker side. I mean, everyone knows, like, Israel in general is more, it's a developed nation, like the economy is doing well, but that's not true for the people you are having conflict with. So, and that leads also to my next question, where since you were in army, you were not just in regular army, but you were in a combat forces, you were in special forces, you were an officer, you had a very massive accident, right? So I'm sure you had like this feeling of closeness to your nation. And now you are in this field of peace building, conflict resolution toward with a certain group who you were fighting against. How do you justify your research and your own biasness against all of this, since you are not just from the other side, but rather you are from the stronger side? And how do you make people on the other side believe the kind of solutions you are suggesting are actually coming from a place of kindness and peace, and not from some sort of big agenda for Israeli side, let's say, in lack of better words?
Yeah. Wow. So these are two very different questions. So I'll start from the first one, and then if I don't move directly to the second one, please remind me to to get back to it. So for the first question, you know, I'd be the first one to acknowledge that you can't study conflicts between two different groups with very, very asymmetrical like power, as if there are two societies here with the same needs, emotions, beliefs, and motivations. There are very clear psychological and other types of differences between what we call the high power group and the low power group within a conflict. We talk about different needs that each group has, and it's definitely not the same experience. I fully agree with that. And I think that the most important difference, at least for me, and I rely here on work of Aryeh Nadler and Rich Nabel, to a social psychologist, that are saying that the most important need for people from the low power group in conflicts is the need to reaffirm their sense of control and their sense of agency in the context of the conflict. I think that what is really, really problematic for people from low power group in conflicts is that they feel like, you know, they don't really have an influence on their lives. So because they're part of the conflict, but mostly because they are the low power side in the conflict, they can do many things, but at the end of the day, most of the control on what's happening on their daily life and on their political life is in the hands of the high power group. You know, if Israel would decide tomorrow morning to stop the occupation, the whole situation of the Palestinians, both on the individual level and on the collective level, will change in one day. The Palestinians cannot make, there's no one decision or not even 10 decisions that the Palestinians can make that would have such dramatic influence on the life of Israelis. And this is a critical point. It's really a critical point. Now, of course, there are also other psychological needs of the high power group, but I think that it is important to highlight the needs of the low power group that are very different and much, much, much more challenging than the needs of the high power group. Having said all that, and I know that it sounds almost like a dissonance, but I will say, people adjust psychologically. And this is amazing. You know, we study both the Palestinian society and the Israeli society. And despite of the fact that, you know, the situation here is so crazy, and every 2 years we have missiles on Tel Aviv and on Gaza, and Palestinians have to go through roadblocks like every morning when they go to work, and it's so difficult. Look at, for example, the measures of happiness, okay, among both Israelis and Palestinians. Levels of happiness in both societies are quite high. And, you know, Israel, the Israeli society is ranked on the top 5 countries in terms of happiness every year in the happiness measure, that is an international measure studied once a year. And the Palestinians are not ranked on you know, much below the Israelis. And you can ask yourself, this, I mean, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense when life are so challenging in so many aspects. How do you explain that? And I think that the explanation is mainly on, you know, what we call the psychology of societies in conflict. Societies in conflict, you know, they develop like a psychological infrastructure, a set of beliefs, narratives, emotions that help them to cope with the conflict. And this is true, you know, despite of all the differences between the high power and the low power groups that I mentioned before, it's true on both sides. Both sides are absolutely convinced that they are right, that they are the moral side, that they did anything possible to resolve the conflict, and the other side was the one to you know, to hurt it and to make sure that it won't happen. Both sides are absolutely, you know, absolutely convinced that they are the ultimate victim. And that's amazing, you know, the fact that Israelis, as the high power side in this group, in this conflict, when you ask most Israelis, they will say, you know, we are the victims. We are the victims of this conflict. And Palestinians will say the same. But this mindset of beliefs, of narratives, it helps people, you know, to live through the conflict and to live through the conflict in a relatively calm and happy psychological environment. Because if you are absolutely convinced that you are right and that you do everything right, and that even if there are some very difficult, you know, situations or events, you couldn't avoid them in any way or prevent them in any way, then you have what you need, you know, in terms of meaning in life, bonding or sense of belonging to your group, a understanding or the belief that you are a good person as part of a good society. And that's what helps people in conflict to live in a relatively good, you know, relatively good life in such crazy situation. I'll just say one more sentence. Mm-hmm. This great, like, quote unquote great, like psychological infrastructure, that's also what prevents societies in conflict from promoting peace. That's exactly the problem. That the very same thing that helps us to cope, and the Palestinians and Israelis and other people in conflicts all around the world, the very same psychological environment that helps us to cope with the challenges of conflict is what prevents us from promoting peace. And that's a huge, huge problem.
I think, sorry, since you said to remind you, you did forgot to answer my second question of how do you deal with you coming from Israel, coming from this high power group, and reflection of that into your work you do.
I mean, how do you maintain objectivity at any level?
So
I think that there are more like a practical way to answer your question. You know, I can tell you, in my lab, I have Palestinian PhD students, and I collaborate with people on the Palestinian side and with people. So these are the more practical, like, aspects of my answer. But I think that you were looking for a much more like substantial like answer. And I'll say that I will say it is very complicated. Let's be honest. It's very complicated. And I think that to some extent, there's a problem with me being an Israeli, being an active part of the conflict, let's say it very, very honestly, and being part of the like high power group in trying to be objective and to be a scientist or a researcher studying the conflict. So it is challenging, and it's challenging on an everyday basis, I must say. At the same time, I truly believe that research and science must play a more central role in attempts to promote conflict resolution and peace. And you know, I can't change who I am, and I can't change the fact that, you know, I was born as a Jewish and an Israeli, and now my options are A, let's not do anything.
Right.
Yeah.
And B, let's try to use the things or the tools that I believe that can be effective and constructive in changing the situation in order to do something. And I also believe that in situations of asymmetrical conflicts, most of the responsibility, both to the continuation of the conflict and for the resolution of the conflict, lies on the side of the high power group. That's very important. And if the responsibility to promote conflict resolution and peace, according to my belief, lies mostly on the side of my group, then I should do something in order to try and change it. So, you know, having said all that, I must say, you know, so I do all I can to try and maintain objectivity in my scientific work. I must say, and you know, it's a problem or it's challenging sometimes vis-a-vis the Palestinian side. On the one hand, you know, Palestinian researchers find it very, very hard to work with us. Very hard, given, you know, BDS and many other processes. And I always, you know, I'm very empathetic to this position, but it's also very, very, very challenging. At the same time, I can tell you, it's very difficult, you know, positioning myself within the Israeli society. Oftentimes, Israelis don't see in a very favorable way the kind of work that we're doing. I mean, for them, when we, you know, even the things that I described to you 10 minutes ago,
yeah,
about, you know, more responsibility on the Israeli side, the fact that we create a narrative that oftentimes is a false narrative, the fact that, you know, the fact that, you know, the Israelis or the high power group trying to present themselves as victims and moral, etc. When I say these things to Israelis, you know, they want to kill me, really. I mean, for them, I'm almost a traitor in the way I describe the conflict. I'm considered as a very, very critical voice within the Israeli society, just by trying to describe things the way they are. But to be honest, I don't feel that I have any other alternative but trying to do the things that we're doing.
Hi again, this is Dave from the editing room. For some of you, the episode length seemed a tad bit long, so we thought we'll introduce a small breakpoint or intermission of sorts by this point in the episode. Even if you're listening it all in one go, this intermission just indicates that we have covered the basic ground of the topic so far, and from here on, we try to push the envelope a bit further by diving deeper into the topic. So feel free to pause at this point and resume the second part later, or keep listening like you do. Hope you like the first part, and let's jump on to the second part.
You mentioned a lot of stuff, and of course, there's a huge scope of debate, argument, and discourse in that. But in the interest of time, and since this has been slightly a murky conversation so far, I would rather like to quote one thing from your 2008 paper, Emotions and Conflict. You described very clearly that threat is one of the reasons that why conflict creates a perception of threat in some cases. So then fear has to be the underlying emotion that perpetuates or maintains conflict. You define hope as a higher cognitive feeling. So now that all of this has been described, now people, including us, understand the situation slightly more better. What are the factors that pushes one from this one end of the spectrum that is conflict, fear, threat, to the other end of this, what you say is hope, which is a higher cognitive ability?
Yeah, so it's definitely, you know, there's so much work, research on fear and hope in situations of conflicts. And I think that, you know, at least my approach would be to say that, you know, fear would always be there. Because fear is like that's almost like the defining factor of conflict. So what is conflict? Conflict is when, you know, when two sides disagree on something and understand that the other side would be willing and able to do something in order to take it from them. Okay, so that's already fear. That's already threat. So fear would always be there. But I think that something that we're often missing in this discussion about fear and then on fear and hope is that when people feel fear, their main goal or emotional goal is not to hurt the other. And that's a key point. You know, we when we study emotions, we say that each and every emotion entails like an emotional goal, right? Which means that when you experience a certain emotion, the emotion leads you or creates some kind of emotion, some kind of a goal or motivation. When people feel fear, very different from hatred or anger or this kind of emotions, what they want to do is not to hurt the other side. What they want to do is somehow to reduce the threat. Okay? They feel like there's some kind of an external threat on them. They also feel like they can't really cope or defend themselves. And the emotional goal is to somehow reduce the threat. And here, I think where hope, which is a higher like cognitive structure, comes into play. Because if you feel fear, you believe that the other side wants to hurt you or take something from you. But you also have very dominant feeling of despair, which means you don't believe that peace is possible, that conflict resolution is possible, etc., then the only way to achieve your goal, which means to reduce the threat, would probably be to attack back, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to do something very, very offensive or aggressive in order to protect yourself, not because you want to hurt the other side, yeah. Because that's the only way to somehow reduce the threat. But if you, on the other hand, you feel threatened, very seriously threatened. So levels of fear are very high. And the most, you know, intuitive reaction would be, I need to do something immediately, mm-hmm. to protect myself. But then you also believe that, you know, peace is possible. The other side is willing to negotiate. I mean, they want to get something from us, but they are also willing to talk to us. And I can imagine a future that is different from what I experience right now, which means I believe that peace is possible or conflict resolution is possible, then there's a possibility that the way you'll choose to address your goal, like the goal of reducing the threat, would be a more constructive way. Because you will say, I want to reduce the threat, but peace is possible, so let's reduce the threat by negotiating with the other side, by offering gestures to the other side, by doing something that can potentially help me promote conflict resolution, not because I like the other side, not because I'm a big fan of them, or because I believe they are right or moral or whatever, but because this would be my way to minimize the threat. And this is where fear and hope can be integrated into the same, I think, the same mindset among some people in conflict.
Mm-hmm. I think since we already just talked about two extremes of emotions, I was thinking what could be like practical ways with which we can bring people who are not willing to find peace from these two different extremes into the middle? Is that even possible?
So I think that, first of all, I mean, there are ways to help people, we use the term to regulate their emotions, to change their emotions, you know, to upregulate their hope, to downregulate their fear, or to downregulate their hatred. I think that there is a question whether the goal is really to bring them to the middle. I'm not sure that that's, at least the way we think about it, it's not always the goal. But there are definitely ways to help people in changing their very negative emotions. And I think that at least the way that we think about it, it mostly, I mean, the most dominant tactics that we use focuses on trying to address the most dominant themes or ideas that are part of the emotional stories. Okay, so I'll give you an example. When we talk about downregulating hatred or trying to reduce hatred, both among, you know, Palestinians or Israelis or people in other conflicts around the world, what we're asking ourselves is, what's the story of hatred? What does it mean for people to hate someone? And we've done some work, you know, experimental and more like a qualitative work. And what we found is that when people hate the other, the basic story or their basic narrative is that the other, I mean, they want to hurt me. They want to take something from me. But it's not just for instrumental reasons. They want to hurt me because they want to see me suffer. And also because, you know, this is the way they are. They will never, never change the way they are. And by understanding the story of hatred, I think that we already went like 50% of the process that we need to do in order to reduce hatred. Because it means that if you want to downregulate people's hatred, what you actually need to do is simply to convince them that even if the other side is doing some terrible things, things that you consider as, you know, very, very aggressive or militant or racist or whatever, they don't do it because this is the way they are. They don't do it because it's like some kind of an innate characteristic that can never change. They probably do it because of the circumstances, the situation, the leadership, the whatever. And what we find in our study consistently, and these are studies that we've done all around the world in many conflict situations, is that when we manage to change this mindset, to make people or to lead people believe that the other side, even if they're doing some terrible things, are doing it because this is the way they are, but because of the circumstances, because of the situation, because of the leadership, because of contextual or situational factors, suddenly their levels of hatred reduce dramatically. And we've done it both, we found similar trends both in lab studies that we did, but also in the field, in many different conflicts, in field studies, when we manage to intervene and to change people's beliefs about the core ideas or the core themes that lead to hatred, suddenly we create some very meaningful changes. And again, I won't talk about different other emotions because I know we have some time limitations, but we do the same or very similar things among, you know, in the context of other emotions as well.
Mm-hmm. The central idea involved here is the perception of the other group, that I hate them because I perceive certain threat. I hate them because of this. I hate them because I identify with my land, my culture and stuff. So when such a powerful thing is involved, because your perception of reality is basically your narrative of what your life is or what your life around is. There are two groups in conflict, let's say, anywhere in the world. And there are many at this point. One sees themselves as their rights have been violated because it was a happy land and then suddenly other people came. So they identify the other people as the terrorists. On the other hand, the other people identify themselves as the liberators, that we are liberating and fighting for our place in the world. So when you have these two things where I don't believe that a regular person, it's very difficult for one regular person to hate another regular person once they know or talk with them. Like the propagation of hatred is one to many. It's easy for me to, let's say, not hate, but let's say negative things about people. For a very stupid example, Justin Bieber fans, right? Not to drop shit on anything. Probably he makes great music for his audience, but it's easy for me to drop shit on that entire group. However, if I go and meet one person, which includes my own brother, unfortunately, it's very difficult for me now to hate him. So coming back to the question. So when you have these conflicting groups where groups hate each other, one considering themselves as we identify with the land and the others considering themselves as, okay, we are the liberators, but being identified as terrorists. How do you spark a conversation between them? How do you change their perception what's the process involved here?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, if I had like a very clear and convincing answer, I would have been, you know, the situation in the Middle East and in many other places around the world would have probably been different. I think that there are several approaches to address this question. One approach would be to say, let's try to deal or to address beliefs that are not directly related to the conflict itself. Because when you talk about issues that are directly related to the conflict itself, then people become very, very defensive, okay? And then immediately they offer like counter arguments and nothing good can happen from this situation. So I can give you several examples for like indirect interventions that we've done throughout the years. One of them I already talked about. So we convince people that, you know, groups can change. They can change over time when the situation is changed. When we've done these interventions, we didn't mention Israelis or Palestinians. We talked about the fact that groups can change more broadly. Or, for example, you know, when we try to promote hope, oftentimes we do it by distancing our examples from the current conflict. So we show people examples for other conflicts which were exactly in the same situation as we are, very, very similar, in which people couldn't believe that anything good can happen in the future, and suddenly something happened. So we don't even mention the existing conflict, but we do something indirectly. I can give you another example of a very cool study that we've just completed. We found that one of the reasons why people don't feel empathy towards the suffering of the other, and it might sound a little bit strange, but it's a very robust finding, is that they tend to believe that empathy is a limited resource. So if I would experience empathy towards suffering of, I don't know, a Palestinian sick child, I will not have enough empathy to express an experience towards people in my own group. So people believe that it's like a pile. They won't have enough of it. So we did interventions in both among Arabs and Jews and in other places, showing that if you only make people believe that empathy is not a limited resource, so they can have as much empathy as they want, suddenly they start expressing empathy towards the other side in the conflict as well. And again, it's a very indirect example. You don't even have to talk about the conflict itself. So one approach would be simply to try and change people's beliefs by using like indirect messages. Another very powerful approach, I think, and we show it in our work, is to somehow take people through very, very powerful experiences. And that's a very important point. I think keep in mind that, you know, most Israelis have never in their life, they've never met a Palestinian. Never. Mm-hmm. Like personally.
Yeah. Yeah.
If they've never been in a Palestinian city, which is, you know, very highly populated, and they've never experienced it. And you can say the same thing about many, many Palestinians. So one of the challenges of people who are trying to promote change like me is to ask ourselves, what can we do in order to create powerful psychological experiences for people that would be so meaningful that they will be create dramatic changes in the way they look at the conflict. So we use VR experiences, and we try to create these experiences because we think that they can be almost like life-changing in terms of the conflict. Mm-hmm. And maybe the last thing to take into account is that most conversations about the conflict can be very, very, very threatening psychologically for people who are involved in the conflict. You know, to tell Israelis that, even mention the word occupation in Israel, it's a big no-no. I mean, for most Israelis, they will not even acknowledge the fact that the occupation exists. For most Palestinians, talk about terrorism, they will say, you know, you said it, they're, you know, freedom fighters, it's not terror at all. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we learned throughout the years that we have to do is to take these things into account. If you really want to bring people in the conversation or into serious conversation, you have to take into account their psychological needs. So you will not have a meaningful conversation with the Jewish Israeli by telling them that they are part of an occupying society or an immoral society. It would simply not work. They will come very, very defensive. And even though, you know, I believe, and I'm sure that you believe, that that's the situation on the ground, it's not very constructive in terms of like creating a conversation. So for example, we have studies showing that if you somehow allow Israelis and Palestinians to reaffirm their morality before they enter a conversation, suddenly they become much more open to discuss even the most difficult and challenging issues. In a way, we're telling them, you know what? You're a good person. You're a moral person. You're just, you know, accidentally involved in a very difficult situation. And after you already proved to us that you are a moral and good person, now let's discuss the real issues. And suddenly Israelis, after going through this psychological process, are much more willing to accept responsibility for the wrongdoings of their group, suddenly are willing to talk about occupation and immoral behavior of the Israeli army and other things. But they do it only after we have, you know, we acknowledged the difficulties of being part of this conflict, and we didn't patronize on them, but by saying, you know, you're simply, you know, immoral people doing immoral actions as part of an immoral like collective.
Yeah. I think you mentioned the word occupation, and just for us and listeners, just to be on the same page, you are referring to the occupation, like occupancy of the land itself. Yeah. Here, right?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. I think we can also somehow relate to this phenomena, because in India and Pakistan is the same thing. We are Indians, and most Indians have never met Pakistanis, except like if you live abroad or if you have traveled, because you cannot really travel to Pakistan and vice versa. So there is just this inherited hate, which exists for no reason almost, because some people have never met the person on the other side. And living here in Germany, for example, for me, I am friendly with some of the people who are from Pakistan, and it's just, you never even realize, because the culture is so similar, the food is so similar, even the language, you can understand each other very easily.
I met one yesterday. And like, surprisingly enough, I don't know what's the status of the train now, but there used to be a train called Samjhota Express. Right. How do you translate Samjhota in English? Compromise? Whose final destination in India is my hometown.
Mm.
And when we were doing our bachelor's 7-8 years ago, then I met a couple, like a family was coming from there all the way till Jaipur. So yeah, it does make a world of difference, because your perception about people when you meet them in regular circumstances changes in blink of an eye, because it's no one comes out, no regular person comes out to discuss that, okay, how to further worsen the conflict by any measure of extent. So yeah, that is very true.
I can tell you a story. When I did my postdoc in California, in the US, in mm-hmm. Stanford, and the person in the grocery store on the corner of the street when I lived was a Palestinian from Gaza. Mm. And
okay,
in many, many ways, when I met him, you know, we felt very similar, mm-hmm. much more similar to each other than us versus the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But one time when we had a conversation, he told me, you know, here in California, we are friends. We go back to the Middle East, I kill you. We laughed and we had beer, and it's amazing, because it says something about how the context in which you're living can actually influence, you know, your feelings and your attitudes in a certain situation.
Like, so the American soldiers are not the solution. American visa is the solution for this conflict resolution.
Definitely, yeah.
just make everyone move to US, right? That's the solution. I'm sure Americans will love hearing this statement.
but maybe going back to the point you said before, which is there is, I mean, I want to highlight the fact that it's not that simple. I mean, mm-hmm. even True. When people meet the other, like meet one person from the other group, and suddenly this one person, you know, it contradicts all stereotypes and views that I had over the other group. So in most cases, what people will do is that they will say, okay, but this person does not really represent the group. They will do something, you know, they will say, so I met one nice Israeli, one nice Palestinian, but true. We call it in social psychology, it's a phenomenon called subtype. So we're saying he's really great and he can be my friend, but most Palestinians are very different.
Right.
So you need to believe that this one person or the characteristics of that one person can actually be generalized to the entire group or the entire population. And this person is not an exception, but someone that can actually tell you something about the whole group. By the way, there are great studies that last month, a great paper was published, not our paper, on the influence of Muhammad Salah and the influence he has. Do you know the football player Muhammad Salah? There's a very, very, very famous football player playing in Liverpool in the UK. Mm-hmm. And he's a Muslim and a very religious Muslim. And he's probably the best football player in the UK today. And there was a paper published showing how the mere fact that Muhammad Salah is such a huge star in the UK actually led to quite a meaningful change in the view of the mainstream UK population towards Muslims more generally. it's a very, very interesting process.
Yeah. No, I can totally imagine that happening for sure. I was like wondering, since we have been talking a little bit more about research and studies so much, I was wondering, how do you like start the process of like conflict resolution at ground at small scale? So let's say you are starting, I don't know, some sort of process at ground. So how does, first of all, that process even start? And secondly, how do you then scale that for masses, because conflict is happening in masses, right? And that is a problem in general in any sort of research. And I think it's more critical in the kind of work you are doing. So very curious, how do you scale that up?
Yeah, it's another question that if I had a perfect answer to this question, we would have been in different situations. But I will say, you know, so I think that in your question, you were very, very accurate in identifying the fact that there are like two different parts to this process, very different parts. So one part is happening, let's call it in my research lab. And the part that is happening in my research lab is asking a very specific question. Basically, the question is, you know, what should we tell people? What are the messages that should be conveyed to people in order to change their emotions, their attitudes, and their behavior in the situation of conflict? So, for example, what kind of experiences or what kind of messages should we convey in order to promote hope, okay? Or in order to reduce hate? And then we do many, many studies in the lab trying to isolate very, very specific messages or ideas that can actually promote hope or reduce hate. And we do mostly experimental studies. You can think of it as, you know, like studies, like clinical studies when you test medicines or vaccines. So there's an experimental group that is exposed to some kind of a message and a control group that is not exposed to this message or exposed to some kind of placebo kind of message. And then we test the effects of these messages on people's levels of hope or levels of hatred towards the other side. And then what we try to do is to replicate these studies also in other conflicts like around the world, because in most cases, what we try to say is that, you know, our results can be generalized to many different conflicts and not just the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then there's a totally different question, which is, okay, now let's assume that we found very, very consistent indications saying that some message or some ideas can mobilize public opinion to support peace or reduce very negative emotions. What do we do with it? I mean, how do we scale up these findings in order for them to actually be effective in creating change? And this is a big challenge, but I think that at least for me, the most effective way that we identified is to work with existing NGOs on the ground. So there are NGOs, for example, in the Israeli-Palestinian context, both on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli side, who use public campaigns or social media campaigns or educational processes within high schools. And we approach these organizations and we tell them, you know what? We can help you to revise or revisit your content, the content of your campaign or the messages you use on social media or the content you use in your like curriculum within high schools, to rely more on science and to rely more on things that we already found in the lab that can really, really be effective in changing people's like minds and hearts. And today we work with, you know, dozens and dozens of organizations, both on the Israeli side and on the Palestinian side, basically trying to incorporate things we found in the lab and make sure that they'll be used very broadly in their work on the field.
I was wondering, since we had most of our conversation around the conflict of Israel-Palestine, rightfully so. I mean, that's where also your background comes from, you coming from Israel. So it totally makes sense to have those examples and discussing on them. I was, and to me, maybe it's because I'm not from the field, to me, it seems more like more of a, if I may say so, like a passive conflict, meaning there is not active violence every day, as far as I know. It happens once a year or twice a year. Something happens, of course, but it's not actively happening, right?
Now it sounds like you bring in the perspective of the high power group. Because I assume that the Palestinians will tell you right. That there is violence like every day. Mm-hmm. And for them, going right. From their, you know, home to work and having to go through 3 roadblocks with soldiers threatening their life, sometimes even using so for them, there's, I think, both like structural and also very physical. For most Israelis, what you've described is exactly the situation. We see violence once a year, once every 2 years or something like that. I think for the Palestinians, it's more of a daily environment. Right. But you're right. It's not like an intense conflict, violent conflict that I agree.
Yeah. So then if we talk about regions like Afghanistan or Yemen or these very like violent places, maybe Syria to some extent, does it even make sense to think about conflict resolution, because the violence is so hot per se, in lack of better words, because we need to have some cooling process before we can even start such attempts, or there is something we can already do from the peace building perspective or conflict resolution perspective, even on these active, I should not say war zones, but active violent zones, if I may say so.
So the answer is yes, but different. So I think that there are very important things to do when violence erupts and when it's ongoing. I'm not sure that I would call them like conflict resolution, peace building processes, but more like trying to do what we define as conflict management. And conflict management is mainly an attempt to moderate the violence on both sides, without even talking about, you know, achieving peace or resolving the conflict, or even without like dealing with the real issues. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, it only means that we have to use like very, very different interventions. I can give you an example. We've done some studies both in Myanmar, in the Burma area recently, around the violence that has erupted, and also in Israel during the violent events in May, when the violence was mm-hmm. all over the streets. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we've discovered was that one of the things that amplified the violence in both places was that there was a huge majority on both sides that actually believed that most people on the other side support peace, support violence, and are engaged in violence. Right. Whereas the actual data showed us that there was a very, very small minority, but by the way, in both contexts, that actually supported violence. Mm. So we created an intervention, a psychological intervention, that is defined as correcting meta perceptions. So let's change what people think that the other side think right now. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that when we showed Palestinians that although they think that most Israelis support violence right now, in reality, this is not the case. And there's a very, very small number of Israelis who actually support violence. Suddenly the support for violence among Palestinians reduced dramatically. And this is something that you can do only when violence is ongoing. And we did the same thing in Myanmar and got very, very similar, results. So,
but sorry not to interfere with thought process, but how do you even get people on ground when there is active war, like active violence going on, to even participate in a study? Because to me, this seems like the last thing I would be worried about, to participate in a study when like my family is dying.
No. So first of all, it is very, very challenging. Very challenging. But one thing that we realized, and this is true, I mean, we find it consistently throughout the years, is that people see research or participating in research oftentimes as an opportunity to express their views. And when violence is around, people really have, you know, they have many things to say. And they really want others to hear what they have to say. So it is difficult, you know, practically, it's very difficult to get to people when people are shooting each other on the streets or throwing stones at each other. But when you get to people, they really want to talk. They really want to talk. And this is true, you know, there are areas in the world in which it's more difficult to do research in general, when people are really threatened and even expressing their views on certain issues is very, very challenging. But still, most people in most cases, they want to talk. They want to talk. They want to express their views.
Interesting. It's totally acknowledgeable that, yeah, I mean, in Israel and Palestine, even it would be difficult to bring regular people together who probably are on one extreme. So I can only imagine a research group going in like Afghanistan at this point and trying to strike the conversation between, you know, two groups that are fighting each other. The more, I think it would be more of an opinionated question because I truly believe that asking people about like fortune telling is never the best idea to go in science, but still just to have your opinion since you have been in the field for over two decades now. Are there some factors that could help us determine whether or not a conflict resolution would be resolved for the long term? Or has there been any example where a conflict between two major groups has buffered for many years or decades and then it was resolved?
So the question to the answer to the second question is definitely yes. I mean, we can see many conflicts that were resolved and the resolution preserved for many years. You know, you can see, you know, first of all, you know, think about, you live in Germany today. Think about the
I mean, Eastern West Germany thing.
Eastern Western Germany. I mean, you can think of many different conflicts within Europe between different countries that were resolved and the resolution sustained for a very long time. Think about the Northern Ireland conflict that wasn't finally resolved yet, but the Good Friday Agreement from 1998 really created kind of a stable peace between the between the two sides. There are many examples. So I'm very optimistic about the fact that it can happen almost anywhere. I think that at least for me, the most important indication for whether or not conflict resolution can sustain for a longer time is whether the parties within the conflict went through a deeper process of like reconciliation versus whether they only like signed a peace agreement, which are very, very different, two very different types of processes. So there's a huge difference, and there are many studies on that issue that differentiates between the formal resolution of a conflict on the one hand versus a deeper process of reconciliation, accepting responsibilities, taking, you know, actions to be more open to the other side's like narrative regarding the events, splitting the and I think that this is the key factor. The key factor is understand, you know, you gave the example of the 94 Oslo Accords in the Middle East, and I had the opportunity to talk to the people who led this process from the Israeli side. Okay. Not necessarily the politicians who don't always tell you the truth, but the actual people, you know, who led the process. Ron Pundak was one of them in the Israeli side, and also the Palestinians. And they told me that this was the key factor that was missing. The key factor that was missing was that leaders on both sides, they thought that they will sign a historical peace agreement and they will make the compromises and then, you know, societies would simply follow them. And they didn't understand that signing the peace agreement is or should be considered at best at the beginning of the process and not at the end of the process. Right. And they have to go much, much deeper into the educational systems on both sides. And into the, you know, the public discourse, both among the Palestinians and among the Israelis, to create or to build trust, to accept responsibility, and they simply missed this point. And then very, very soon after they signed the agreement, you know, the violent re-erupted. And it wasn't very surprising for people who understand these processes, because the parties have to go through a process of what we call healing. And if it doesn't happen, then things will come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that also lead us to towards the end, because I think we already took more of your time than we promised. But first of all, I would say thanks a lot for this wonderful and enlightening conversation for two of us, and hopefully also for our audience.
So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Hey guys, if you have reached this point in the episode, then thanks a lot for listening to the entire episode. We really hope that you find the episode informational as much as we did. Before you leave, just one small request. If you want to keep track of what we are releasing every week or want to know more about the additional content which we produce regularly, please follow us on our social media. Our Instagram is info under the radar. On Twitter, we are at @info_under_radar. We are also active on LinkedIn. That's also info under the radar. That's it for now. Bye.